Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in once again as we are rummaging through our monster box of 5,000 plus cards, gathering dust in the back corner of a bedroom closet in my house for many, many years. But these cards, they're beauties. They're all from the 1980s. We're going set by set, year by year, and we're taking a look at the final set from 1985, 85 Tops, a set that is very unique, really good. I like it, but it's a little quirky. But then again, so was 1985, if you're old enough to remember what was going on in the world and in the U.S. then. It does have a very Shebop Cyndi Lauper look to it. So we'll talk about the 85 top set, our random pull, card number 577, Chris Speier. Yes, that's how you pronounce the name, S-P-E-I-E-R, Speier. A longtime infielder for several major league teams. We'll talk about his career and the incredibly smooth airbrushing job that Topps gave Chris Speier on his 85 card, number 577. Yes, we will talk a little bit about airbrushing, as that was a key to many of the cards we collected in the 1980s. First, let's get you up to speed on our comments from our listeners, and thank you so much for listening and sharing the podcast with everybody. As I say pretty often, in fact, almost every show, share this with one friend, all right? A friend that you know who collected cards or still collects today. Just say, hey, you got to check out this Wax Ecstatic podcast. Just let them know about it. They can find us on Audio Boom, and you can always tweet us with your questions, comments, random thoughts at Wax and Gum Stains. Again, Wax and Gum Stains is our Twitter handle. Whole lot of activity going on since our last podcast about 85 Fleer. And I mentioned during that podcast that 85 Fleer was very hard to find. It's not scarce by any means, but it's a little harder to find than other card sets from this era for a couple of reasons. One, it's hard to find in mint condition because those gray borders, not as bad as the 85 Donruss black borders, but the gray borders of 85 Fleer, not that easy to keep in pristine condition. So you have to track down cards in pretty good condition if you're worried about value and trying to have that quote-unquote perfect card set. The other reason is Fleer allegedly in 1985 reduced its production a little bit, so it's not as plentiful as Donruss or Topps may be, but also because of some of the star power in that set. Roger Clemens rookie card, Kirby Puckett rookie card, and that is the base set rookie cards, not the update set, because Fleer had them both in the 84 Fleer update. But the true base rookie cards of Puckett and Clemens, you had second year Mattingly, you had Ripken, you had Boggs, you had Gwynn, you had Sandberg, you have Ricky Henderson. You had so many great players there. There was some value to this set coming out of the factory. So it's a little hard to find 31 years later because people are still sitting on those cases. And that's not to suggest that there's 10 billion 85 Fleer cards just sitting in warehouses somewhere, but I wouldn't be surprised if some very astute collectors picked up the complete sets and the wax boxes and maybe even some cases, and even as early as 1985 or 86, just kind of stored them away because they knew that this would be something very valuable for many reasons down the line. So we had Gio and Alex chiming in, mentioning that it was very hard to get these cards. Gio saying, I remember looking all over Brooklyn for packs at the time, nowhere to be found, settled for a complete set at a show. That's pretty much the only way you can get the 85 Fleer now. It's even hard to find those loose wax packs or complete boxes. You really have to do a search for it, not just online, but you know, you actually have to leave the house and go to a card show like Gio did. Alex also mentioning it's impossible to find in St. Louis as well. St. Louis was a tough Fleer market, 84 to 89. And again, Fleer producing some of their better cards during that time stretch, but I think reducing production just a little bit, although the production would go up, I would say, in 88 or 89, as the collecting hobby just boomed into a business. You had everybody collecting cards, and then certainly by 89, when Upper Deck came out, then all of a sudden everybody was creating their own set of cards. Also got a question coming in not too long ago from Baseball Card Backs, pointing out the back of the 1988 score, card number 449, Ron Kittle. And Baseball Card Backs pointing out that I left out the prodigious minor league baseball home run totals in Ron Kittle's career. Now, this goes back to our 84 Donruss podcast where we pulled Ron Kittle by pure chance. Of course, we were talking a lot about Ron Kittle during the 1983 podcast because a lot of collectors were going for the Kittle cards and kind of chucking aside the Samberg, Gwynn, and Boggs rookie cards, which of course would stand the test of time, and Kittle really just having that one outstanding 1983 season and then having a pretty good but not great career after that 83 season. And you're absolutely right, Baseball Card Backs, as Kittle had 40 home runs, 103 RBI in 1981, and then he had 50 home runs, batted .345, was the Pacific Coast League MVP, Minor League Player of the Year with the White Sox Farm Club in, I believe it was Edmonton. And it was either Edmonton or Vancouver. But anyways, he was a star in the Pacific Coast League. So I do stand corrected here in the sense that Ron Kittle didn't just magically appear in 1983 to deliver that outstanding season. He actually had a pretty good track record in the minor leagues for a couple of seasons leading up to that major league success he did have. But what he did have was in 1982, with 20 games and 29 at-bats. He batted .241 with one home run, seven RBI. So from a major league standpoint, Ron Kittle in 1982, very few people could have imagined Ron Kittle would have turned into what he did in 1983. It's actually very similar to our story of Doug Loman, the 1985 Donruss random pull, where Loman had a great career in the minor leagues, but just couldn't transfer that into the major leagues. And he is what we call a 4A player, a guy that was great in AAA, but kind of came up short in the major leagues. So he was branded a 4A player because he couldn't quite make that transition. Ron Kittle looked that way in 1982. Turned out in 1983 that was not the case. So good point there, Baseball Card Backs. Thank you for correcting the record a little bit. Yes, Ron Kittle did have some outstanding seasons in the minor leagues in 81 and 82, but I'll go back to my original point in the 84 Donruss podcast that in the major league performance in 1982, it was a stretch to imagine that he would have been as great as he was in 1983, as were the Chicago White Sox that particular season. Finally, a very interesting question coming in from Stretch. His Twitter handle is the only one Avenger. And this was a question that was so good, not only did I attempt to answer it, but I opened it up to our listeners as well. And the question was, which 80s set do you think is most iconic and should be owned? Now, this is a very good question, but it is also a very loaded question because there's a lot of different definitions of iconic. Because what's iconic to me may not be iconic to you, may not be iconic to the next person. So I followed up. I said, well, define iconic. Are we talking about design? Are we talking about value? Are we talking about, you know, star selection in a particular set? So Stretch followed up with mostly value and future value. So let's answer Stretch's question. If you're looking for value and future value, I would have to say 83 tops is probably your best bet. Of course, you've got the value in the three big players that we mentioned when I was talking about Ron Kittle a moment ago, Wade Boggs, Ryan Sandberg, and Tony Gwynn. You had those rookie cards. You had the young stars that were starting to emerge during that time. So you've got some value there in just the star power. But also, I have to say that the 83 top set in terms of design is a very popular design, very fan-friendly. As I mentioned in our 83 Tops podcast, there's a lot going on with that card, with the two pictures, jamming in the team name, the player's name, the position, yet it all somehow works. So it looks good. The backs are easy to read, that light orange with the black text on the quote-unquote white background, but with the gray cardstock. It was basically a gray background. So the cards look good. There's not really any issues with condition, you know, pretty much when you pulled a card out of the pack, unless it was miscut, it was in good shape, something you couldn't say for like 85 Donruss or 85 Fleer with the darker color borders, you know, with the white borders. It held up very well through time. So I would say 83 Tops is probably, in terms of value, both value now and value, say, 10 years from now. While I can't predict that the value of that particular set won't depreciate over time, I would say the odds are if there was one set of baseball cards from the 1980s that will increase in value, I'm not going to go as far as saying, oh, it'll go up tenfold, but at least something that will hold its value and maybe add a few dollars to it over time. 83 Tops is the one that stands out. Now, if you're also talking value, let me throw out these other possibilities. 83 and 85 Fleer, the 83 Fleer set for the exact same reasons as Topps, star power, design, quality of cards. Also 85 Fleer, as we mentioned in our previous podcast, because of how nice they are, star power as well. If you can get a set that's in really good condition, I think that's a good set to put in a box, stick on a shelf, hang on to it for a while. It may appreciate in value as well. Moving on to Donruss, 84, 85, 86 Donruss sets, I think, are good, affordable sets that you can either collect or just go out and buy the set and sit on them for a few years. And then from Topps, 84, you've got the star power. You've got a very popular design. Also, they are a little more plentiful in number, so you're going to have a little bit of a lower value just because there's more Topps in the market from 1984 than Fleer and Donruss. But it's a lot easier to pull that set together, and it's a fun set to pull together. It's a really neat set to have. So 84 Topps is one, and 87 Topps. That's one of my favorites. I call that a low dollar buy with a lot of upside. And you look at 87 Topps, you not only have the legendary, you know, wood grain design, the backs of the cards are easy to read, the quality of the photography is pretty good, but you look again at the star power, the rookie cards in there. You've got Barry Bonds, you've got the first base rookie card for Jose Canseco, Bo Jackson. You also have some star cards who had their rookie cards a few years before, of course, Clemens and Puckett and Gwynn and Sandberg and Boggs and Ripken, Henderson. But also the veterans are very strong in there. Nolan Ryan, Mike Schmidt near the end of his career, Reggie Jackson as well. And also some guys from the late 70s who had turned out some pretty good careers by 87. Dale Murphy, Paul Molitor, Robin Yount, you know, a whole slew of players. Carlton Fisk, you know, Jim Rice still had a card in the 87 set. Freddie Lynn did as well. You know, there's a lot of star power to it. So 87 Topps in particular, in terms of value, because there's a lot of 87 Topps that's out there, you can acquire that set for probably as low as $15 or $20. And that's one that I think if you leave on a shelf for many years, I'm not going to guarantee it's $50 or $60, but I would say that's something that still has some value to it, as opposed to like an 88 Donruss or something like that. So that answers the value question. But, you know, iconic sets in the 80s, the first one that comes to my mind is 87 Topps for the reasons that I just expressed there. I also think in terms of iconic, you have to look at, you know, in terms of design and just really sticking, you know, with you. I mentioned this in our podcast, 83 Fleer, 84 Donruss, because they've really set the bar for those companies for many years to come. And I would also look at in 1989, you know, when the market was starting to get flooded with different sets, Upper Deck is a set that you can still afford now. Even though it's pricier than others, it's a little more limited than others. Granted, you're not paying off your college loans with the Ken Griffey Jr. cards like we all thought we would back in the day. But because that was the first complete set from a company that really turned the hobby on its ear, if you can attain that, that is a good set to have. And I also suggest 89 Topps. Very underrated set. You've got a lot of star cards, rookie cards, young star cards, and Randy Johnson, Craig Biggio, Tom Glavine, John Smoltz, you know, a lot of the guys who would become leaders in the sport throughout the 1990s represented well in 89 Topps. So it's a pretty open-ended question, and I encourage our listeners to respond to it at any time at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. We did have a few responses, so let me very quickly run through these so that we can get to our random card pull and talk about the 85 top set. We had Cheese Curd say 83 tops. Sports Carter, 83 tops for nice design, good rookies, not as many printed as the later 80s. Also, Samuel Watkins, 83 and 85 tops. Shane Katz, 84 Donruss. Sean Graney saying the 83, well, he just says 1983. I'm assuming it's tops as well. Ted Ziegler with a whole list of sets, but 83 tops at the very top of the list there. And let me see who else. We had one more chime in. Oh, Ryan Stonebreaker. He likes 86 tops, one of his favorites. He's even designed some cards for a local high school team that he covers. Everyone's got a different opinion on what is iconic. Share it with me. I'd be curious to know what it is. We've already seen the scorecard, a lot of people liking 83 tops, but maybe there's another set from the 80s that is quote unquote iconic to you, and maybe not for value reasons, but maybe it was the first set you collected. Maybe it's the first set you completed. That's another reason why I like 87 tops, because the cards were so plentiful even in the early 90s. I was able to buy boxes and boxes of them and put together complete sets. In fact, while rummaging through another box of cards that I have, and I mean a big cardboard box with all the small white boxes in it, I found I still have an uncompleted 87 top set. I'm probably 20 cards shy of completing. So when I have some free time, I'll finally do that. It might be your first set that you collected, the first set that you bought a pack for. Maybe it was a set that was given to you as a birthday present or a Christmas gift or something like that. At Wax and Gum Stains, let us know, what is your most iconic set of baseball cards from the 1980s? All right, 85 tops, somewhat iconic, I guess you could say, because it's such a memorable design, and in kind of a quirky way. I have always liked 85 tops, and one is not only the design, but as opposed to Fleer and Donruss, they were a little more available to me, the thrifty collector back in the late 80s and early 90s. Granted, because you had Clemens, Puckett, and as it would turn out, the 1984 Olympic rookie card for Mark McGwire, which of course became a staple in the hobby when McGwire was chasing Roger Maris's home run record back in 1998. There's a lot of value in those cards, but even though you had some pretty good star power there, there were still just enough cards out there to where if I wanted to buy a pack or track down a lot of cards, I could do that. And so 85 tops is one of my favorites just because it was a little more out there, more available than some of the other sets from that time. But I've also liked the design. Let's take a look at our pull here. Again, card number 577, Chris Spire, as we have a white border, so no complaints about chipping from Fleer and Donruss collectors. A white border. You've got the player picture dominating most of the card, I'd say about 85% of the card. And then the quirkiness comes in. At the bottom, in this angled rectangular strip, you have the team name. To the right of it, in a circle, you have the team logo. And you know how much I love team logos. So A+ for including the team logo. And with the Chris Spire card, you've got the vintage. And of course, it's come back now. Everything old is new again, right? You've got the vintage Minnesota Twins, Twin Cities logo here, which is really cool. I love this kind of alternate logo, because you had the T and the C for many years, but the one with the state of Minnesota and the Wind Twins and the Mini and the Paul guy shaking hands, that's a classic. I love that look. Right below that, you've got the player name and position, and I've always liked this card because it's quirky, it's easy to look at, even though I look at it now and I go, wow, compared to Fleer and Donruss, it's kind of clunky. Actually, it's very clunky, but in a good way. Like I said at the start of the podcast, it's clunky in a 1985 Cyndi Lauper way. This is something that you would see slapped on something on MTV. This may have actually, this design may have been slipped into the background of the Dire Straits Money for Nothing music video. There is a 1985 feel to this card. And Topps always tried to do that. They tried to design their cards to represent the time. And even though it's a little clunky and a little goofy with all the shapes just kind of laying around at the bottom of the card here, I have to say, if you black out the picture, if you black out the team name, if you remove all identification and you just have the shapes, basically a silhouette of the front of the card design, You show that to anybody who collects cards, and I bet you 95 out of 100 will go, oh, that's 85. They'll know it's 85 tops. And the handful who probably don't know are probably too young to remember when 85 tops came out. So it's a very iconic design, not necessarily the classy design of Fleer, not exactly the serious design of Donruss in 85, but it's a very iconic, fun, interesting look to it. I've always liked it for some reason. Although, again, as I look at it more and more, I cringe when I look at where the team name is, because you know what that rectangular bar looks like? I'll give you a few seconds. Take a look at that. Yeah, it looks like the bubble gum that came in 85 tops and tasted like it was manufactured in 1955. So I do get the shakes a little bit when I look at that, because it does kind of look like a piece of Topps chewing gum laying on its side, keeled over in its chemical imbalances. It's about to disintegrate in your mouth because clearly there is some chemical in it that you should not be digesting. But you're a fool. You're a foolish car collector, and you still chew the damn gum anyways. So despite that, it's a very good look. And what really makes this Chris Spire card so special, the airbrushing. I mean, has a Minnesota Twins jersey ever looked as fuzzy as it does on Chris Spire in this card? Now, poor Topps, even though some artists went through the trouble of airbrushing this card, because Spire was on the move in 84. He started in Montreal, had a few weeks in St. Louis, then finished the season in Minnesota. Well, by the time this card was released to the public in the spring of 1985, he was already in Chicago. April 8th, 1985, he had signed as a free agent with the Cubs, and he would spend a couple seasons there before finishing up his career in San Francisco. So the poor artist, who already gets knocked around because, I mean, it's airbrushing. It's just not the real picture, right? It's this fuzzy Twins batting helmet and this fuzzy powder blue attempt at a mock Twins jersey on Chris Spire in a picture that's probably 3 or 4 years old, but it's the only one where you can't see his teammates or what ballpark he's in or what jersey he was wearing before. So the artist had to make do. Well, the poor guy, he works his heart out getting this card done, and then lo and behold, by the time the season starts, he's on another team. And all you have to do is just Google bad airbrushed baseball cards or something like that, and you will see even worse jobs than this. This is actually a pretty decent job, but you'll see, like, you know, Cardinals players wearing pink shirts. You'll see, you know, guys whose cards were so airbrushed it almost looks like the whole thing was a painting. Airbrush cards are just legendary from that time, as you well know. So if you're bored, you can Google bad airbrush baseball cards and get an eyeful of just some truly awful attempts at airbrushing. Not as bad as some hockey cards. I remember 89 tops, Randy Cunnyworth. They basically, with watercolors, kind of drew on a Winnipeg Jets sweater. There's a couple others. I think Dave Babich had a really awful Hartford Whaler sweater that they tried to paint on. So it wasn't just baseball. It was elsewhere, but certainly more predominant in baseball, as teams trade players a little more frequently than other sports do. And poor Chris Spire on his way to the Cubs, but wearing this fuzzy, I'm sure guaranteed to withstand the effects of weather with proper staining, this painted-on Twins jersey and batting helmet. Let's flip the card over, as I've always liked the card back for 85 tops for a couple of reasons. One, it breaks the mold a little bit for tops here in that they aren't cluttering the back up, even though I like logos like we saw on the back of the 84 card. This was a little cleaner, and also, you know, in that Topps chewing gum shape of a rectangle in the corner, you have the player's name, upper left-hand corner. You have the personal information to the right, and then you have the whole litany of stats in Chris Spire's case here. And I've always been intrigued. I love it, even though normally it doesn't work, but somehow Topps made it work. The ectoplasm green and pink border. So it's pink text, I should say. It's a little Ghostbusters meets Miami Vice meets Topps chewing gum on the back of these cards. despite this very unholy matrimony of colors of lime green and flamingo pink on top of the gray cardboard stock, it somehow works. And I always liked rummaging through 85 Topps cards because the backs were just so weird looking. But it worked. Like I said, it somehow worked. And that pretty much describes the entire 85 Topps set. Even though the design was definitely 1985, even though the colors, especially on the back, were 1985, even though the airbrush jobs were definitely 1985, there is just a really fun, cool, albeit quirky, look to the 85 set. And even though it's not the best set that Topps put out, and if you compare it to 84 and 83, 87 even, it probably doesn't really match up in terms of design as those other sets. But, you know, it looks good. It amazingly looks good, and it stands out from the rest of the competition. The 85 Donruss set was serious, as I called it. The 85 Fleer set was almost regal. It was kind of the gray poupon of 85 sets, and certainly the Fleer sets throughout their history. 85 Topps is just quirky but fun, and certainly set itself apart from the other two companies. So I like 85 Topps. I think this may be one of the sets, though, that kind of falls in the same bucket as 81 and 82 Topps, where you either like it or you don't. I like it. I know most people I know who collect cards like it, but there may be some people who don't because maybe they don't like the pictures, maybe they don't like all the shapes at the bottom, but at the very least, you get a geometry lesson. There's no doubt about that. Now, as for Mr. Spire, he had a very productive career in the major leagues as he played 19 years. That's right. Made his major league debut in 1971 with the San Francisco Giants, was a three-time All-Star with the Giants, drafted by the Giants in 1970. He was the first round pick, second pick overall in the January secondary draft. He was originally drafted by the Washington Senators back in 1968, but he decided not to sign, and that was actually probably a very good thing. Of course, he was also at UC Santa Barbara, continuing his career there, and quite frankly, getting a better opportunity with the Giants. As I mentioned, three-time All-Star, 72, 73, and 74. Traded to the Montreal Expos in 1977 for another long career infielder, Tim Foley. He would play with the Expos up until 1984, as I mentioned, bouncing around a lot in 84, traded to the Cardinals for Mike Ramsey on July 1st, and then just 6 weeks later, traded to St. Louis for a player to be named later and cash, the wonderfully named Jay Pettibone, heading to St. Louis from Minnesota in that deal, and then signing as a free agent with the Cubs, and then the Giants once again, who he would wrap up his career with. Surprisingly, not a World Series winner in all of his travels, although he did get some playoff experience with the Giants in 71 and 87, was part of that magical 81 Expos team. You can argue which team was better, 81 or 94. 94, of course, the strike stopping that team. 81, Rick Monday and the Dodgers stopping that team from making it to the World Series. But a very good career for Mr. Everyman. He was primarily an infielder, doing most of his duty at shortstop, but also serving quite a bit of time playing third and second, couple games at first base. Pretty good batter, too, especially for a middle infielder. Batted .246 over his career. Had only 112 home runs, but a pretty good on-base percentage, or a decent on-base percentage, I should say. .327. While he didn't stand out at the plate, as you would expect most middle infielders to do, he was pretty solid as a fielder. Not gold glove worthy, but a guy who would average his fielding percentage anywhere between 97 and 99%. So he was pretty dependable over the years. And as you would imagine, like many players, Chris Spire, when he was done as a player, he would move on to the coaching realms, as he was a coach for the Arizona Diamondbacks when they won the World Series in 2001. So even though he couldn't pick up a ring as a player, he did get one as a coach. He was also a base coach for the Chicago Cubs, third base coach for the Cubs in 2005 and 2006. And he would tend to follow Dusty Baker around. He went on to Cincinnati, and he is now the bench coach under Baker with the Washington Nationals. Now, there's an awful lot of Spire family in baseball. Justin Spire, his son, had a pretty good career as a relief pitcher throughout the 1990s. And then Gabe Spire, he is the cousin of Chris Spire. Gabe Spire in the Arizona Diamondbacks system now. He's been bounced around, traded several times throughout his career. So you had son Justin Spire, relief pitcher in the 90s, early 2000s. Gabe Spire still trying to make it in the big leagues, but the Spires are still plentiful in baseball, much like his card, number 577, and much like 85 Tops. As I mentioned, it's a fun, it's a quirky set, even though it may not be Tops' best of the decade, and I don't think the best of the big three card makers in 1985. It's a good set to have. Very affordable, too, because, again, Tops made a few more cards than Fleer and Donruss did that year. So you could get a complete set relatively easy. I know you can get wax packs and boxes a lot easier than other card offerings from 1985 or the mid-80s in general. So if you have some extra cash, a little more disposable income, and you want to invest in a good set with some good rookies and some good young star power and a neat design, 85 Tops is definitely one that you will want to look at. Now, while 85 Tops had a very 1985 look to it, I challenge you to find something that was more 1986 than Donruss. Yes, 86 Donruss, or as I like to call it, the Max Headroom baseball card. That is what we will be looking next at on our next podcast, which will be coming your way Tuesday. In the meantime, don't forget to share this podcast with a friend of yours. Share our Twitter feed as well, at Wax and Gumstains. And we always welcome your questions, comments, and even the attaboys. Just saying thanks for putting the podcast together. It's my pleasure to do it for collectors who still collect now or maybe gave it up years ago, but I have a lot of great memories about some of the great cards and players and airbrushed photos that we got out of the 1980s. I'm Matt Salmon, your host for Wax Ecstatic. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time.